My name is Peter Verlustein. I am an independent analyst on jihadi groups worldwide. I've been doing this since the outbreak of the Arab Spring and the war in Syria. I'm by education a historian and an Arabist, so my knowledge of both history and the historical methodology and the Arabic language helps me a lot to understand and get a grasp of jihadi groups around the world.
Peter, you've been researching terrorist groups for many years, and I'm keen to understand why they try to radicalize people. What do they gain from it?
The phenomenon we saw when the Arab Spring broke out and the Arab revolutions, basically, and then the war in Syria, the rationale they had in mind was we destabilize a country that's already unstable and we take advantage of that. We take a foothold there and we can create a caliphate. That was basically the idea that was behind the whole reasoning of both Al-Qaeda as the Islamic State. It's based on a theory first posed in the early 2000s by one Abu Bakr Naji. And in that text, Abu Bakr Naji, an Al-Qaeda ideologue, basically describes the different steps to be undertaken before the creation of a caliphate. When the Islamic State popped up in Syria, after they gained advantage by the chaos in the country, they immediately started propagating that material as well. For example, in the very first issue of their English language magazine, Dabiq, they described a simplified version of Idarat al-Tawahhush in just a few steps. And they followed it by the letter, and they're still doing it right now in Africa and Afghanistan.
Interesting. But for people in society who probably don't know much about these groups and, may have a family member who has been radicalized or there's been a terror attack in their neighborhood, how would you explain the radicalization ideology of terrorist groups to them?
Well, the Islamic State, one of their core values, if you want to call it like that, is the idea of brotherhood and equality. So basically, all these frustrated Moroccan guys here in Belgium, for example, who joined the Islamic State and other groups, their idea was that they didn't belong in Belgium, but they also didn't belong in Morocco, for example. So if they wanted to go somewhere where they were equal to their brothers and where there was the idea of creating an Islamic caliphate again, that's what attracted most of them. And of course, there were a lot of psychos as well who just went to Syria to kill. But most of these guys weren't really religious when they left, actually. They were just a band of friends, a bunch of friends who left early in the war and who ended up there, stuck there for several years. Most of them have been killed by now. But we see the same processes basically happening in throughout the Sahel, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, where the Islamic State sees discomfort within the society. They try to create an opportunity by that. They try to profit of the from the situation of these people and by promising them that they will take care of law and order in the area. But then they obviously impose draconian interpretation of the Islamic law to these people as well.
It's interesting that you say that many of these people who went and joined these groups weren't really religious. They did it because they felt like they wanted to belong somewhere. But these groups want to create a brotherhood, a caliphate, and that's all linked to their religion. But then there are also groups, for example, in the US, like the KKK and the other groups, that it's very socio-political radicalization. So, is it religion or socio-political factors which shape extremist groups' ideologies?
No, basically, religion is used to justify the social, economical, and political motivation of most of these people. Religion is just a cover-up. We can clearly see that in how the Islamic State, for example, used Quran and a Hadith to justify some of its actions. This one example I'm thinking of is the burning of the Jordanian pilot Mu'assal Kassasbeh, who crashed into the lake near Raqqa with his fighter jet and who was publicly burned by the Islamic State. So basically, they filmed the whole thing and they published it. It was a horrific video. They explained it as the rightful killing, an eye for an eye, rightful killing of a pilot who bombed people in their houses who were burned alive and then burned by the rubble. So they did exactly the same to him. They burned him alive and then they buried him by rubble. But then there is a verse in the Quran that says that only God can punish with fire. But the Islamic State always tries to find some obscure text that will justify their actions. And here again, obviously, they did find texts. Another example, the throwing down from tall buildings of homos and lesbians. That's very disputable because it isn't in the hudud, the Islamic penal law. It isn't inscribed there. But they found the text which says throw them down head first, and then if they still survive, stone them to death. And that's exactly what they did. So they always found some way to justify their actions that were very brutal. In some cases, indeed, led by social, economical, and political grievances, justifying whatever they did. And they've been very creative in this, and they are still using this same tactic over and over again. The bigger recruitment base, especially in the early 2010s, 2012, 13, when a lot of people from Belgium also left, their recruitment pool were young, frustrated, uneducated, or poorly educated youngsters from mostly Moroccan origin here in Belgium, who felt completely outcasted from our society, and they saw something very promising not too far away, so they decided to join.
I was wondering, in the US after the 9/11 terror attacks, a lot of questions popped up in the public sphere as to why the terrorists did this and why terrorists from the Al-Qaeda group hated Americans. How would you explain Al-Qaeda's ideology to Americans still questioning 9/11?
Well, don't forget that 9/11 was preceded by a bunch of other attacks by Al-Qaeda. We have the attack on the USS Cole. I don't know if you remember if it was before or after 9/11, but we also had the attacks in 1998, if I'm not mistaken, on the embassies of the United States in Dar es Salaam and in Nairobi. Al-Qaeda was already propagating that it would start a war against the United States. Osama bin Laden was very clear in it, in his two fatwas, especially the second fatwa, which was a declaration of war against the Zionists and the Americans. So the whole idea of Al-Qaeda was that the United States deserves to be attacked because basically they are the main supporters of Israel, which unlawfully claims Al-Quds, Jerusalem. That was the whole religious idea that was posed by bin Laden and propagated also by the following leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri. Ayman al-Zawahiri actually was the main architect, probably, of 9/11. He persuaded bin Laden to perform the attacks. And there always have been, obviously, impactful large attacks by Al-Qaeda, but Al-Qaeda turned and evolved the last few years into focusing on the near enemy instead of the far enemy. And that's a paradigm shift that has happened after Osama bin Laden got killed, actually.
What do you mean by near enemy rather than foreign enemy?
The near enemy, for example, Al-Qaeda on the Arabic Peninsula, Al-Qaeda in Yemen, they have a branch that is trying to launch international attacks, but the main focus is on the Houthi rebels and the Yemeni government. Shabab in Somalia is solely focused on the near enemy, so the Somalian army and government. It has not claimed any major external attacks yet. You can see this actually, almost the entire Al-Qaeda landscape that they have shifted.
So does this mean for countries in the West, radicalization from these terror groups is no longer such a big threat as it was before?
No, it will go on. But the problem is right now, the opportunity 10 years ago was much bigger for these guys because basically, if you're living in northwestern Europe and you want to go to Syria, it isn't that far and it isn't that difficult to go to. You just have to travel to Turkey and you can cross the border. Same counts for American citizens, for example. They just had to take a flight to Turkey and then they crossed the border into Syria and they were in the war zone. Going to current theaters of operation for the Islamic State in, like, for example, Afghanistan or the Sahel is a lot more difficult. People will still keep radicalizing. It's no doubt about that. That's going to continue the trend. But the bigger mobilization for the jihadi crowd in the war theaters, as I shall call them, seems to have diminished a bit, at least. Now they are more focusing on local population and not so much more on foreign fighters.
How have the tactics extremist groups use to radicalize people changed over the years? You've been researching these groups. What are the kind of messages they send to people to recruit them?
The way it's happening now is probably the way it's always been happening, mostly via contacts, personal contacts, or social media contacts. The way it happened in the past, like 10 years ago when the first guys left, it was mostly peer pressure, family pressure in a way, social contacts, friends, messages that they received from people they knew who hadn't joined jihad in Syria already. At a certain point, I was infiltrated in the networks of Belgian jihadis, and I could clearly note the importance of their old physical networks that had been translated into a social network that spanned all over from northwestern Europe to Syria, Iraq, and beyond. So social media played a crucial role. If it wasn't for Twitter, we wouldn't have seen this massive recruitment. Facebook, Twitter, WhatsApp, Instagram, all these platforms, they have been infested with jihadi propaganda and jihadi recruiters, and well, now they are returning again, and basically, they've never really been away.
What are the messages on social media channels that they put out there?
The official groups mostly don't, they did that in the past, but nowadays it's calm. They don't openly recruit anymore on social media. Most of these contacts are peer-to-peer, so basically, people who know each other from years before who get into contact again and start persuading the other one to come over. That was the whole idea. For example, we had in 2016, we had a terror campaign in France, which was led by a French jihadi, Rachid Kassim, who was leading a network on Telegram, Sabre de Lumière, and he was basically giving instructions to his followers in France to, for example, priest Jules Duhamel in Normandy to stage an attack on the Notre Dame. Luckily, the attack was foiled. And there are dozens of other examples. And that was a network, Sabre de Lumière. Sometimes the guys who were involved there only knew Rachid Kassim via the Telegram account, never met the guy in person. Even the two guys who killed the French priest Jules Duhamel in Normandy, they had never met before the day of the attack itself. So they just communicated via the Telegram channel and they agreed to perform the attack. The main idea is people still tend to believe that there is a phenomenon called lone wolves. In my idea, lone wolves don't exist. They're always interconnected, being physically, being via the internet or whatever, but there is always a connection. There's nobody who radicalizes by himself, not even by watching hours of propaganda. You always need to have a physical or very persuasive connection who can get you that little step further than normal people go.
A lot of the people who get radicalized, they are isolated from society. For example, the case of Shamaima Begum, she went as an ISIS bride as a teenager. Now she's returned to the UK and has said that what she did was a mistake. She's apologized, but she's lost her appeal for British citizenship as well. What are your thoughts on such cases? How should societies and governments help former extremists who are keen to undergo the de-radicalization process?
I'm not going to completely answer your question, how society should treat them, but I'm just going to give you my opinion on de-radicalization. In my idea, de-radicalization does not exist. Once you've been there, you can never go back. The way they pretend to be de-radicalized, I'm talking about Belgian ISIS families and Shamima Begum as well, and hundreds of others. That's pragmatic. That's basically trying to get out of the horror that was Syria at a certain point for the Islamic State. So they had to do something. But I'm not really convinced. Most of these guys who come out of prison nowadays, when they get posed a simple question, I'm again referring to a Belgian example, Jean-Louis Denis. He was the leader of a Belgian recruitment group 10 years ago or so. He got sentenced. He came out a few years ago, I think. And the first thing he said when they interviewed him, I am more radicalized than ever. So he was not de-radicalized. He radicalized even more in prison. And in my idea, once you have been in touch and dominated by the idea of the Islamic State, I don't think there is a way back. I'm doubting it. There might be individuals, but I'm not really sure that most of these guys can return safely to a normal life.
But do you think that that's where governments need to play a bigger role? Because, I mean, for example, aren't governments curious enough about why people got radicalized in the first place? And then they try to understand the ideology of terror groups and find solutions to help?
Governments could do a lot. So basically, after the foil attacks, February 2019, the Paris attacks, November 2019, the Brussels attacks in March the following year, we took very repressive and short-term measures. As the government at that time said that we are going to clean out, we have to clean out Brussels and we have to clean out Molenbeek. The main focus was very short term. They didn't, for example, clean up Molenbeek. They cleaned out Molenbeek, but they didn't clean it up. They didn't create job opportunities. They didn't invest in education. They didn't invest in the city environment itself. On it's it was all always very, very repressive. That was the whole idea behind it. And in my idea, radicalization, one of the main feeding grounds of radicalization is lack of education, lack of knowledge. That's why we should invest more in education. I mean, general education. A lot of these guys who left for Syria, when I spoke to them when they were on the ground, they contacted me to translate Arabic for them. Can you imagine? They were fighting for Allah and for Islam, but they didn't speak any Arabic.
Were these like Belgian fighters who went there, or?
The Belgians didn't trust me, but I was in contact with a lot of Dutch fighters, for example, and they talked to me and they tried to convert me and they tried to win me for their holy war. Obviously, I'm not interested, but it was interesting to talk to them. I had long conversations with a lot of high-ranking ISIS profiles and Jabhat al-Nusra profiles.
What are the lessons that societies across the world can learn when it comes to sort of tackling threats presented by these terror groups?
On a longer term, we can have a whole other discussion on that. I don't see any silver bullet appearing immediately. The main advice I would give now to the international community is to please take care of what is going on in Africa, especially in the Sahel and in Eastern Africa, in Congo and Mozambique, because the Islamic State is gaining ground there like hellfire. And that's the next big threat, Africa. Basically, when we see that throughout the Sahel, Mali, Burkina Faso, France, and the rest of the European Union is drawing back its troops, they're leaving the countries, they're leaving them not only to the jihadis, but also to Wagner Group. The Wagner Group right now is one of the most influential groups throughout the Sahel and Central Africa in with regards to gold production and go on. In the Wagner Group, we all know that they are very operative and very active in the Ukraine as well and in Syria and go on. So if we tolerate this to be happening at our southern border, I'm talking for Europe, that's an issue, but not only an issue for Europe, but also for the United States on a longer term, because we're basically enriching Putin and his regime by tolerating the Wagner Group.